This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have interviews and observations from the Great British Fly-In at the Smithsonian, a review of lithium-ion thermal runaway containment products for use on airplanes, and a few interviews from Sun & Fun. In the news, we look at a deal to resolve the subsidy dispute between some U.S. airlines and those in the Middle East. The F-35 reaches a developmental flight test milestone. Allegiant Air is criticized in a CBS investigation. A standoff missile makes an operational debut. And 787 Dreamliners with a Trent 1000 Package C engines get a reduced ETOPS rating. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 499 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Brian Coleman. He's our associate producer. Brian, you are back.
I am back, and I'm so happy to be here, able to walk again and recovering quite nicely. So thanks, everyone, for the well wishes, and looking forward to a great show tonight.
Are you still on good drugs, or use all those up?
No, yeah, use them all up. So I'm back to booze at this point. So, okay. Yeah.
All right. Also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year. He's also an expert on learning to fly and purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Max West, how are you?
I'm still smiling here and grinning about Brian being back on booze. Gosh, I hadn't realized that's a good way to deal with pain, I guess. And actually, some people do, I guess. But, oh, well. Yeah, and I must say, we certainly had fun chatting here prior to the beginning of the show. So it's like we're all smiling and grinning here.
Yeah, too bad most of it's not fit for public consumption. But we had a good time. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor, and he also publishes the Jetwine blog. Hey, Rob.
Hey, good evening from Chicago, where we had an inch and a half of snow last night.
Did you?
And it's the middle of April.
Hopefully we're done with that sort of stuff. David Vanderhoof is also with us. He's our aviation historian. David, how are you?
I'm good. I'll see his 1.5 inches of snow, and overnight we had 6 inches of rain.
Whoa! Wow!
So it was a bit of a flood zone this morning in my new neck of the woods. So, but other than that, I had a 5.5 hour trip home yesterday, which is normally a 3 hour trip because of the rain. But it was worth it, as we will hear later.
That's right. David had a great adventure yesterday, and we're going to be hearing all about that. And he's got a couple of interviews for us as well. Well, we have no guest this episode, but we do have a lot of aviation topics to talk about. Why don't we get started right away with the news? Is everyone ready?
Ready. Ready from the West.
Ready.
Our first story comes from the Chicago Tribune. This is U.S. and United Arab Emirates' near deal to solve airline subsidy spat. This is according to sources. Well, reportedly, some discussions are progressing that would resolve the subsidy dispute between some U.S. airlines and those in the Middle East. We've talked about how Delta Airlines, American Airlines, and United Airlines primarily have some issues with what they feel are subsidies, government subsidies, that are enjoyed by some Middle Eastern airlines. Well, we see here in this report that Emirates and Etihad Airways would, under this deal, make their accounting books available and would also assert that they have no plans currently to add additional flights to the United States. Now, this is similar to a deal that was struck in January with Qatar. In that deal, Qatar agreed that they would, within 1 year, release audited financial statements for Qatar Airlines in accordance, quote, with internationally recognized accounting standards. And then within 2 years, Qatar would disclose any transactions with any other state-owned entities, such as caterers, companies that support the airline operations. So it's kind of all based on unnamed sources, but according to this article, there are a number of them. It's kind of an interesting solution, I guess, to this back and forth over who's subsidizing who. It's kind of a little different than I thought we might see. What do you guys think? Max T, any thoughts on this one?
Boy, I don't even really know where to begin on this one. Of course, my first thought is when people open their books, is that the original set of books or is that a separate set of books? Or, I don't know how clever the accounting might be. And I just don't know if this is really going to be satisfactory or not, but it's interesting.
Yeah, Max T, I definitely agree with you on there. I think that there's so many ways of hiding information in your accounting practices. Finding it is difficult. Plus, I know, for example, because a friend has been a pilot for Emirates, where he was a pilot, he's now flying for someone else, where they do the subsidized housing for the pilots in Dubai. And is that considered part of airline operations or is that provided through a separate company? Therefore, it doesn't show up on the books of the airlines. And if you can pay pilots and pay for their housing and school and medical and every other benefit that he had and not have that be part of the airline cost structure, it's still, I think, a way of skirting the issue and hiding these subsidies. The article talked later on, which I thought was really interesting, about the through flights that they have, what the Fifth Freedom flights, which I find a very odd name, but you know, it's not only the Gulf carriers that are doing this, and both countries have accused each other of taking advantage of this loophole. And I know specifically, for example, Air New Zealand has a flight from Los Angeles to New York to London. And technically, Air New Zealand's not allowed to sell tickets from Los Angeles to New York. They can only sell them Los Angeles to London. But there are cases where they do make those seats available. And that is certainly breaking the spirit, if not the rule of law in that particular case where they're not supposed to be providing those flights. So it's a messy, complicated issue.
It is. I'd like to know where the Fifth Freedom's title comes for those kind of flights. It's probably obvious once you hear it, but I just don't happen to know what it is. But another thing that I wonder about when I see this is, if they're going to open their books, their accounting books, to who are they going to open them up to? I mean, if Delta Airlines opened its books up to United Airlines, that would be antitrust probably, or at least certainly it'd be proprietary information. So I don't know who Emirates and Etihad are opening their books to, if there's supposed to be some third neutral party in this or what. I just don't know, but the State Department, the U.S. State Department is involved in this. They say discussions are ongoing, but when asked about this, they only said that there's nothing to report at this time. So we'll have to wait and see when the official notification comes out that there is some kind of a deal. Next up, we have from the Air Force, U.S. Air Force, F-35 completes most comprehensive flight test program in aviation history. Now, this comes from the F-35 Joint Program Office, JPO, and they say that the F-35 program, quote, has accomplished the final developmental test flight of the system development and demonstration phase of the program. David, maybe you can help explain what that means. We do see that the development flight test program has been running for over 11 years, more than 9,200 sorties, over 17,000 flight hours, more than 65,000 test points. Does this mean that the F-35 goes into full production, or just exactly what does this mean?
My brutally honest answer is God only knows. in all fairness, the test program for the F-35 is far different than any other test program that's come before it, because somebody in their infinite wisdom decided that the test program and implementation of the aircraft should occur simultaneously. So as we are ramping up production, we actually have production aircraft in place that are, as the new testings come online, those factors move into the production line, which is already in motion. One of the reasons why this was such a huge testing program was because it's, like I've said before, even though people don't want to hear it, it's three different aircraft. Three different aircraft with three different in-depth capabilities. And you could almost enroll four different aircrafts if we're talking about things like the Norwegians, which have spin chutes, and the Israelis that have different avionics and electronics in them. But the first flight of AA-1 was 2006, and that was your basic land-based Air Force version. You have to then factor in all of the testing involved with that aircraft, followed by all of the testing that was involved with the B version, which is the vertical of the STOVL, or short takeoff vertical landing version for the Marines and the Royal Navy. And that testing, complicated by the fact that it's got a very large fan in the center of it, and followed at last by the C version, which has got a larger wing, different landing gear, and is conventional takeoff and landing from an aircraft carrier. So you have three different aircraft completing multiple tests, and yes, the original A's were a proof of concept. As you grow out further, you've got B's that have to be proof of concept and C's, and it was all managed by the Air Force as far as the test program goes. So the Navy's going to reach initial operational capability next year in 2019, but it's basically all of the preliminary testing that has been involved, and we need to go back and implement anything learned retroactive back to the ones that are already have reached operational capability. So it's kind of a bizarre way of doing business, and I don't think the Pentagon will ever do it again. Mm. But does it mean that the aircraft that are coming down the line will be standardized now? No, because they keep folding in new technologies. Testing will go on forever with this program, but I think it's a little disingenuous to say that it's the largest testing program for an aircraft. If you can imagine the testing programs over the years for an F-4 Phantom, that would be a different animal whatsoever because of all the different variants, not to mention that the F-35 is, like I have said previously, three different aircraft.
All right. Well, as we record this, it's Monday evening. On Sunday evenings, there's a program called 60 Minutes on the CBS television network. And just yesterday, as we record this, CBS presented their findings on Allegiant Air after, I guess, a 7-month investigation. And they call the airline the most dangerous airline in the United States. Quite a program. We'll have a link to an article or two about this in the show notes that you can take a look at if you missed the show. Rob, were you able to see the 60-minute program on Allegiant Air?
I was, actually, and I hope I'm not going to be restricted from saying anything about it since my daughter works for CBS these days. But I'm sure it's okay, because no one needs to tell anybody that it's her father that said this. But seriously, it's a sad state of affairs, really, that we could still have a situation like this going on in the States. And the report tried to make it look like FAA did nothing, and just allow this to go on. And the FAA did something, but let's just say they haven't really, gotten into the spirit of the law as far as customers might be concerned. And there are an awful lot of people in the U.S. that probably have no idea listening to a news story about an Allegiant Air MD-80, losing an engine on takeoff or midair or having smoke in the cockpit or the cabin was getting to be almost a weekly event here in the States until recently. Now, why it's changed, I don't know. Has it gotten better at the airline or is reporting different? We don't have any idea, but people that fly on the airline seem to be very surprised. However, that said, what do you expect for an $89 round trip fare from the East Coast to Vegas?
I expect to take off and land at more or less the airport that I bought my ticket from and to arrive there safely. That's what I expect.
Well, that's a fair expectation. And I think what I was trying to hint at is that you can't make that much less money on a route than everybody else without cutting corners somewhere, I bet. And there have been an awful lot of service difficulty reports, that are public on Allegiant. And all you got to do is go read them. And it's pretty questionable.
And that, I think, was the key thing. I watched the show last night, and I was really struck by the comment that CBS had gone to do a Freedom of Information Act on maintenance reports from the FAA. They got them from a number of different airlines. And the only one that objected and didn't allow theirs to be released was Allegiant. And then apparently 6 days after the interview where they had interviewed John Duncan from the FAA, the FAA decided to overrule Allegiant's objections, and they went ahead and released the reports. And what CBS said showed that, on average, Allegiant was nearly 3.5 times more likely to have midair breakdowns than American, United, Delta, JetBlue, and Spirit, which I find interesting because I think Spirit is also a low-cost carrier. I've never flown Allegiant or Spirit, so I'm not real familiar with them. But yeah, if you kind of look at just that raw number and say, wow, 3.5 more times likely to have midair maintenance problems, that to me is enough of a red flag where you kind of want to pull the covers back and say, hey, what's going on here anyway?
So here's another one for you. In finding guests for the show, I end up talking with a lot of people and was talking with this one woman who identified herself as a flight attendant for Allegiant, and she was talking about leaving the airline and getting a job at the FAA as a crash investigator. I said, oh, that's really interesting. Why are you looking to leave the airline? And she says, I am scared to fly on them. This is coming from a flight attendant, which, you know, think like pilots, they would probably know better.
Well, Allegiant has issued a statement in which they called the 60 Minutes report, quote, grossly misleading. They also noted that this story was instigated by a terminated employee currently involved in a lawsuit seeking money damages from the company. The statement is published pretty widely, including in the news articles we'll have in the show notes. The tone of the statement seems to be that Allegiant today is different than Allegiant was in the past, and what CBS has presented has been misleading. So I really can't evaluate that. You can take a look at the statement yourself and kind of reach your own judgment. But the overall thing that occurred to me as I was looking into this is that, yeah, if there's an airline that has maintenance practices or policies or procedures or whatever that make them less safe than they should be, I don't want to find out about it from CBS. I want to find out about it from the regulators, from those who are charged with ensuring that our flights are safe. So it, to me, it's kind of a little disconcerting that that isn't the case here. And I'm not sure exactly why that is.
Well, I think something you have to keep in mind is that it depends on how you measure safe.
Hmm.
I mean, safe to you might not be the same as safe to me. There are people that might say, well, safe means they haven't had any crashes, right? That's pretty safe.
Hmm.
I mean, but there's an awful lot between the way Southwest or JetBlue or United or American fly their airplanes, which are obviously much younger than Allegiant's, and those crashes. And I don't think we would be, you know, fair about this if we didn't mention that the fellow that runs Allegiant Air is also one of the guys that ran ValueJet many years ago. The same way, was a very, very ultra low cost carrier, and they went bankrupt after one of their airplanes crashed in the Everglades after takeoff from Miami. When they, later they found that a number of oxygen generators, which are considered hazardous material, were loaded on the airplane, and they caught fire. So, could that have happened to anybody else? Maybe. But it happened to ValueJet, and they went under.
And Rob, along with that, wasn't there something where they weren't stored in the proper place? And so they were kind of cutting corners to make the transport of the oxygen cylinders or generators. I can't remember the details of the story, but I just remember that there was something where, again, they were cutting corners in order to more efficiently or expeditiously move it as cargo, as opposed to the way that it really should have been handled.
If my memory, which, of course, who can say much about that these days, if my memory serves me, I believe that what happened was that the oxygen generators were not properly secured in something that would have prevented them from catching fire, I believe. I might, you know, one of our listeners might be able to help on that. I just don't honestly remember, or maybe they weren't supposed to be carried at all. Again, that was 20 some years ago.
Yeah, I seem to recall that they were not labeled properly, and that they surmised that they might have fallen over once they were on board there. I seem to recall, I'm not 100% sure on this, I think I read that they are still looking for a mechanic who they have apparently plan to bring charges against, and 20 years later they can't find them. Now I could be wrong on that, but that's just what I vaguely remember reading here sometime in the last few weeks.
All right, well, I think we'll be hearing more about this. There certainly are a number of parties that have skin in the game, including air travelers, and we'll see what happens. It's kind of hard to predict what'll happen next, but
Wait, Max.
Yeah.
Max, wait. I'm getting a phone call. Hang on 1 second. Hello. Oh, Allegiant. Oh, in charge. Oh, that would be Max Flight. Hang on just 1 second. Max, can you take a call from Las Vegas?
Oh, he's not here.
Oh, he's not. Sorry, he's not here.
Oh, very good, Rob.
Can I ask a really stupid question?
Of course.
Where the hell do they fly? I never hear of this airline other than accidents, but they don't fly anywhere around me.
I can tell you exactly what they do. They have two hubs. The first one, I think, was in Sanford, Florida, which is very close to Orlando. And all of their flights either went to or from Sanford, which was a good choice because it's close to Disney World. So a lot of people wanted to fly cheaply there. And their second hub is
I think they moved their that hub to Clearwater St. Pete Airport.
Oh, okay.
So, but I think you're right. Originally, it was Sanford, and it's since been moved.
Got it. And then the other hub was Las Vegas. And so there are a bunch of West Coast flights, including from Stockton, California, which is about 50 miles from here, where I do a lot of instrument training. They've got a couple flights a day that go, like all the other West Coast flights, to Las Vegas. And so it's kind of interesting route structure. You can't really get from the East Coast to the West Coast. You can basically fly, you know, to and from Vegas and to and from a place in Florida. At least that's what I remember from the route maps. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's take a look at a really different kind of an issue, back to military. And this is concerning the strikes launched against the Syrian government facilities that were supporting chemical weapons from the United States as well as its French and British allies. And we have a couple of articles that describe just exactly what took place, especially from an aviation standpoint. And we see that there were certainly a lot of Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles used, but also this joint air-to-surface standoff missile extended range. David, this was something, what, developed by Lockheed Martin and launched from B-1B Lancers, I guess?
Interesting. Okay, this was self-satisfying because on my part, because we had a change in warfare that occurred on Friday night. We have always used TLAMs or Tomahawk land attack missiles as standoff weapons.
And define standoff for us.
Standoff meaning that you're not flying over the target with a manned aircraft. You are using a remote aircraft, a drone, and you are out of the area where their air defenses are. So that would be, so you're standing away from your targets in a safe area. A year ago, we used Tomahawk land attack missiles. In this case, we used the Tomahawks as well as the JASSM ERs for the United States, SCAMPS, which is the French version of the Sky Shadow, which the British used. No aircraft actually entered Syrian airspace besides the missiles. Two B-1s launched 19 of them from their rotary bomb bays, and basically they're little airplanes. They come from a long line of standoff cruise missiles. The ALCM, which is where the Tomahawk came from, believe it or not, the Tomahawk was originally going to be an air-launched cruise missile. Now it's a vertical launched missile out of ships and submarines. But the Tomahawk and the ALCM, which was the air launched cruise missile, were originally nuclear weapons. Then they converted the Tomahawk to the TLAM, which is a conventional warhead missile. The JASSM, this was the debut of this weapon system, and believe it or not, it was the upgraded version that made its debut, which is an extended range version of approximately 600 miles. So you can imagine they were well away from the radars. They're also very stealthy. They have stealth incorporated in them. They're very quiet. They're single motor, and they're like little jet airplanes. They have the ability to loiter over a target, be reassigned to target mid-flight. And this is going to be a new role for aircraft. Aircraft like B-1s, it's ironic that B-1 was designed to be a penetrator, to fly low, fly fast, to go below radars, and to actually attack their targets physically by flying over them. And now, years later, we're using the B-1s as missile trucks, to be brutally honest, and to fly beyond the range of the Soviet and Syrian radars and launch these missiles with a high rate of accuracy. Japan wants these. The nice thing about the JASSM is not only is it can be carried by the B-1, which they had 19 of them, two aircraft launched 19 of them, but they also are small enough to be flown on things like F-15s and other jet aircraft in the U.S. Air Force inventory. So it's a multi-role weapon system, and it protects our pilots, which is really the amazing thing, is we're not putting our pilots in jeopardy by flying over sophisticated surface-to-air systems. We can now launch these from our safe areas. In this case, it was Saudi Arabia, because they took off from the from Qatar and launched them into the target area. So aviation warfare changed dramatically. And I think part of the jasms was, and this was said a couple of times, was it also was to send a signal to Iran as well as North Korea that we don't necessarily need to be over your territory to be taking out your targets.
There's an interesting video. It's from Lockheed Martin, and it's old. It's from 2008, but it shows these JASSM missiles being, I guess, striking test targets in the desert. But it's kind of, you know, you see this little airplane-like thing that comes screaming down, and it's clear that these things can be targeted with this really, really high precision. I mean, these things can basically fly in the front door almost.
And I see in the notes somebody put the deconfliction line.
Yeah, in many of the news reports about this and the statements from the government, they talked about the deconfliction with the Russians was active during all of this. Is that something that's been set up to, I'm guessing, to prevent U.S. and Russian aircraft from interfering with each other?
Shooting each other down, yes. Mm. Well, not only Russian aircraft and U.S. aircraft or allied aircraft, but all aspects. The deconfliction line is from all aspects of the warfare that's occurring in Syria. It's not a very big country, and there's a lot of people there. But basically, we communicate with the Russians, and we're not giving them complete details. We're just telling them, you know, we're going to be operating in this area, or our armor is going to be in this area, or our aircraft are going to be flying over this point approximately this time. So, and the Russians are the same way. We are going to have blank at, so it's kind of a communication system, but in this case, we said we might possibly maybe be operating some aircraft in the immediate vicinity of one of the cities approximate, you know. So it's not very, it's very generic information because we don't want to give away all of, I mean, to be honest, our president probably gave away more information than what the deconfliction line did by his tweets. But yes, you can send all your comments and complaints to me. So it's a very interesting way because technically we're all supposed to be on the same side, but we're not. But we don't really want a mistake to escalate to something that might move to all-out warfare with the Russians. You can equate it to the modern version of the red phone.
David, yesterday, went down to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum at the Udvar-Hazy Center in Northern Virginia for the Great British Fly-In. Tell us about that.
Well, you know me, I'll find an excuse to go to the Smithsonian for anything. But in this case, it's the 100th anniversary of the Royal Air Force. And we'll hear from the adjunct in one of our interviews. For people who don't know, this took 18 months to plan. And it was really a celebration of all of our RAF allies who are stationed here in the United States. I don't think people realize the amount of military personnel from other countries that live and are part of the activities here in the United States on exchange programs or supporting their embassies. And in this case, they wanted to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Royal Air Force, which has always been an ally of ours, up through last Friday, believe it or not. So I did a couple of interviews. The nice thing was the weather sort of held out. It was a rainy, cloudy kind of day yesterday. But what made it kind of special was, like Innovations of Flight, they actually had Royal Air Force aircraft fly in and park in the back so we could go out and look at the biggest one was the only Lancaster bomber flying in the in North America, which is Vera from the Canadian Warplane Heritage. She was there. Some of the aircraft didn't make it, but Grumpy, which was the B-25D, made it. A BT-17 Stearman. One of the really interesting things was the United States Navy sent up a P-8 Poseidon, which for all of those people who insist on liking tubes with wings, that's a 737 with a bomb bay. But why it was there for the Royal Air Force celebration is in Jacksonville, the home of the P-8 training squadrons, the RAF is going to acquire 8 of these, and they sent this aircraft up with a complete RAF crew. So it really was a celebration of the future of the RAF as they're training to and working up to fly the P-8 Poseidon in Great Britain. And there also was de Havilland Chipmunk. So we had a lot of trainers and 2 bombers, but as well as the Royal Air Force drill team and some really good lectures. But I guess, Max, you want to hear more. People don't want to hear me. They want to hear the interviews.
Okay. So what do we have up first? Assistant Air Attaché?
Yes, this is Steve Richards, who actually was the one who planned the program. As he said, he was a little homesick because he's part of the British Embassy and works with our United States Air Force. He's the assistant air attaché. The air attaché is above him. And they work on programs together, but it's pretty self-explanatory. So why don't we roll tape?
I've snuck into the building, and now I'm here with Royal Air Force Assistant Attaché Steve Richards. Steve, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks.
That's my pleasure. Welcome to the Edvar Hazy Great British Fly-In.
So tell me about what your role was with the Great British Fly-In.
Well, I guess it all comes down to me. The buck stops here. We dreamt this up and started planning this 18 months ago, and we wanted to have a program of events in the USA which mirrored events going back home. Because none of us can get home for that, obviously. So we're out here serving in the USA. And I wanted to make sure that we had a centenary celebration out here. And also to use it to reinforce our relationship with the United States and the United States military. So that was the genesis of the program.
And luckily we've got okay weather. It was a little dubious.
Okay, yeah.
But so tell me about, what is your role as assistant air attaché?
Well, obviously, I work for the embassy, and we're here as in a military guise to integrate and ensure that our relationships with the military, in my case specifically United States Air Force, but not exclusively, is smooth, and that we generate new programs and projects together in the right way. We assist those who work in the United States so that they get a smooth ride and that there's no problems. And it's generally making sure that we march forward together in an integrated manner.
We have a lot of listeners in Great Britain. Tell me a little bit about your career before you got here to the colonies.
To the colonies. Well, before that, I was based in the United Kingdom for many years. I was an air defense navigator. So I flew the Phantom and followed by the Tornado F3. I then went and did the usual staff tours. And also then commanded the rear crew training squadron, number 55 reserve squadron, before it folded. And then enjoyed some time in Germany, working for NATO on the air command and control side, before coming out here as assistant air attaché.
So what did you like better, the Phantom or the Tonka?
The Tonka. The Phantom taught me what I needed to know about the basics. But the Tornado F3 taught me a lot more. It was a lot more. I had much more situational awareness in that aeroplane. And by the time the aeroplane was retired, it was actually quite capable. And it was a shame it had to retire.
So you're proud of your Tornado team over the last couple of days, correct?
I am proud of them, yes. They're doing what they need to do.
Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for your service. And anything else you'd like to say about the RAF here in the colonies?
Well, the RF out here in the United States of America, we're doing great things, and we really do appreciate the assistance we get from our host nation. They're fantastic, and they allow us to go together, as I said, step in step, and work together for the future. We're really looking forward to it.
Thank you for your time.
All right, next we have, David, Doug Berkey.
Doug Berkey brought in a BT-17, very pretty yellow wing Stearman. You know, if people know me enough, they know I love Stearmans. However, it was kind of disappointing when I found out that the markings were a bit superfluous and fanciful. But Doug, surprisingly, didn't fly the airplane in, even though he owns it. He hasn't received his license yet. His wife, Heather Penny, was the pilot. Heather has, unfortunately, I only driving in the car home did I realize why I recognized the name Heather Penny, otherwise known call sign Lucky. Heather was one of two pilots from the DC Air National Guard in F-16Cs on 9/11. She was tasked with intercepting what eventually was the aircraft that crashed in Shanksville. She and her pilot, her wingman, actually she was the wingman, her command pilot, did not have any weapons aboard their aircraft. They were not loaded for that. So she was faced with the knowledge of having to fly, if necessary, having to fly her aircraft into the side of the aircraft that eventually crashed in Shanksville, because that was the one that was supposed to hit either the Capitol or the White House. But on a more positive note, let's talk about Doug, and let's talk about a little bit of a Stearman in Royal Navy colors.
I'm with Doug Berkey. Doug bought one of my all-time favorite airplanes, but in markings I've never seen before. Doug, thanks for being on Airplane Geeks. Tell me what you brought today to the museum.
It's a PT-13 Stearman. It was built in December of 1942, and it served throughout the United States in various locations, Maxwell Air Force Base in Mississippi, and then Goodfellow Air Force Base in Texas. And then after the war, it was deaccessioned, turned into a crop duster. It was restored in 2003 by a gentleman that did about 8 in a row. And the first batches he did in the standard blue and yellow, and he got tired with it. So he began kind of inventing schemes. This is a bit fantastical. They obviously never served with the Royal Navy. And so it's a little imaginative on that front. But past that, though, the airplane's very stock in terms of the condition in which it was restored and all that. So,
And how did you come to acquire it?
We got it about 2 years ago. It had come up for sale. It was living in Idaho at that time, and a gentleman with a very large collection was rearranging things and going to acquire some new items, so I needed to make some room in the hangar. So we got it. He had just done a major Iran on it with new panels and electrical system and things like that, so we were happy to pick it up and flew across country to get back home, and now it lives in Washington, D.C.
And what's your flight experience?
I don't have any. My wife is the private pilot here, so I need to finish up my license, because it's kind of ridiculous to own something like this and not be able to fly. It's like owning a Ferrari and having to call your buddy to go take a ride in it, which is a little ridiculous. So we're readdressing that problem set this summer, that'll be good. And people in the area are interested. We do rides in it and things like that. And the company name of that is Wide Wings, so it's widewings.net.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of disappointed that it's fantastical, because I really love the gray over gray and the yellowy.
Well, the joke is we should put a cardboard torpedo underneath it and say we're going to go off and sink the Bismarck, because it kind of looks like a small swordfish.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much. Again, what's the name of the website?
Widewings.net.
All right, very good. And next up, Flight Lieutenant Cole from the RAF.
In our quest for women in aviation and women in the military, and are supporting that, Flight Lieutenant Cole was giving a presentation of the women in the Royal Air Force over time as a historic presentation. So it's pretty self-explanatory. We talk about her career and some anecdotes about the RAF.
I'm finally sitting down after a couple of hours of walking around, and I'm privileged to have Flight Lieutenant Cole from the Royal Air Force with me. Flight Lieutenant, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, tell me a little bit about your career in the RAF.
Well, I joined the Royal Air Force in 2007. I just finished high school, and I was fortunate enough to be allowed to go to the academy without having got an undergraduate degree. So I commissioned as a 19-year-old, second lieutenant equivalent, in 2008, and I've been in the Air Force since then.
That's interesting that you have to have an undergraduate degree normally to go into the RAF Academy, unlike here in the States.
Well, the RAF College at Cromwell isn't an undergraduate granting institution, so it's purely a leadership academy. So 80% of people have undergraduate degrees when they enter the academy. And the rest of us, 20%, come in straight from high school and almost apprentice ourselves in the year that we're there on leadership.
So after that, what was your career like?
After that, I went to specialist training, which at the time was called the Admin Secretarial Branch, which sounds like a bit of a...
40s, not politically correct.
Correct term. So we rebranded ourselves Personnel Support Officers, and that's been my main trade ever since. So my first tour was actually at the Defence College of Aeronautical Engineering, where I was in charge of discipline, and actually got heavily involved in STEM education.
So what kind of roles are there for the RAF for women? Let's talk about your career, a career for a woman in the RAF, since we talk about that a lot on the show. So for our UK listeners who are young girls, what would you recommend?
I mean, I don't think I would recommend at the moment anything different to a young woman than I would a young man, and I think that's a great place to be. 100% now of roles in the Royal Air Force are open to women. We now have no barriers. You can be an RAF regiment officer at the front of, you know, close combat. You can be an engineering officer running an engineering squadron of technicians and engineers. You can go down the personnel route like I have. And you can fly, obviously. And, you know, we've had Fastjet female pilots since 1994.
And are you based here in the States or are you still over in the UK?
No, so I'm actually based in the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. I've been here since December. I've just about got used to driving on the other side of the road. So it's slowly becoming home.
And how long are you going to be on this tour?
I'll be here about 3 years. So it's not my first chance to live in the U.S. I actually was at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. For 6 months previously, and I've served two operational tours, one in Afghanistan as an exchange officer with the Marine Corps, and the other one at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar with the US Air Force.
Wow, that's... What were your takeaways from some of that? You've had a lot of exchange duty.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes it can be interesting, the culture. I've learned to throw a football. I've taught some people to throw a rugby ball. I've started to drink coffee as much as I drink tea. So, you know, I think we're much more similar than we are different.
So what, is this the first time you've been to this museum?
Yes, actually this morning, I was lucky enough to come in at 6 o'clock in the morning with the advance party and have the museum to myself for half an hour, and it was impressive, amazing actually.
I say the same thing about when I go to Hendon for the Royal Air Force Museum.
Yeah.
This is home for me.
But we don't have a space shuttle in the UK.
Granted, but you do have a Sunderland.
That's true.
Although we have one in Florida, but that's your equivalent of the space shuttle at the RAF Museum in Hendon. You walk in and go, ooh. So yeah, being here when it's closed and off limits. So the Discovery was something you found very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen it before. I've never been that close to anything as impressive. And later on, I'll be giving a brief in front of it. And I've got to say, it makes a difference from a conference room on an RAF station.
What is your briefing going to be on?
My presentation will be on women in the Royal Air Force. So all the way from the start of women's Royal Air Force in 1918 through to what we're doing today.
And in the first 100 years, what was the first roles for women in the RAF?
Honestly, the first role for women in the Air Force was actually very similar to today. So even in 1918, we had female engineers and female technicians. And the reason that they established a women's service was to free up technicians from the UK to go forward to France to support the RAF in France fighting against the Germans at the time. You know, back then, women didn't even drive cars, but the Women's Royal Air Force had women on motorbikes delivering messages. There was a great BBC documentary recently about the Royal Air Force, and one of the female transport pilots from the Second World War tells a story about getting out of her aircraft, having landed at an Air Force station, and being asked who's the pilot, and saying, "I'm the pilot," and them saying, "You can't be the pilot," searching the aircraft, thinking that they were having a trick played on them. And when they realised actually she was the pilot that had flown this aircraft, you know, across the skies of Britain, which at the time were riddled with German aircraft. And when they realised that it was in fact her, she was invited to the officers' mess for a sherry and a lot of handshakes.
Very cool story. Well, I know you've got a busy day, but thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you very much.
All right, great conversation, David. Now, we have one more, don't we?
Our next is a very short interview with Dr. Peter Jacob, who is the head curator of the Air and Space Museum, and a little bit about what's going on at NASM.
This is David. We're here at the RAF 100 celebration at my favorite place on the planet, the Udvar-Hazy Center. I'm here with Peter Jacob, chief curator. Thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
My pleasure.
So tell me a little bit about this day.
Well, the Air and Space Museum has been observing the 100th anniversary of the First World War since 2014, and we've had a variety of exhibitions and programs and activities associated with that, and this is one of them. Of course, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Royal Air Force today, which began during the First World War.
And your chief curator, tell me a little bit about your role at the museum.
Well, I'm responsible for all of the research and collecting and exhibition activities that go on here at the museum. We have about 24 historians on our professional staff who do all of that activity.
And tell me a little bit about the how much involvement do you have about the renovations downtown?
Well, the National Mall building, which opened in 1976, is in need of some significant repair. So we have broken the project up into two portions. One is called revitalization, which is the repair of the building, which will be an extensive repair of the systems, as well as reskinning the entire building with new stone, all of that sort of thing. And then what we call transformation, which is the new exhibitions. There'll be 22, 23, depending how you count, exhibition galleries, new exhibition galleries, and we'll be doing that over a 7-year period and kind of doing half the museum first and then flipping over and doing the second half of the museum. But we will remain open to the public throughout the project. There'll always be something to see on the mall building.
There's always something to see here also.
Yes.
I have to admit, I got to get downtown because I want to see the 2001.
Yes, we have an exhibition on the 2001 A Space Odyssey, the 50th anniversary of that film. And it's an immersive experience where you get to go into the what's essentially the stage set of one of the closing scenes of the film.
Well, thank you for your time. And luckily, we got some decent weather. Not great, but decent weather to be outside recording this.
Well, as I say, it's always the sun is always shining inside the National Air and Space Museum.
Very good. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, my pleasure.
Oh, very good. David, are we able to officially announce that we'll be invited for this year's Innovations in Flight Day on June 16th?
Well, I think you just did. Or should I say that when it came up about some of our friends are bringing their airplanes, I said, what about us? And they said, oh, well, we were basically expected. So I think the answer is yes, we will be there in June.
That's great. So we'll look for as many of you as possible to join us. That's June 16th at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, Udvar-Hazy Center, just adjacent to Dulles Airport in Northern Virginia. We've been doing this for a number of years now, David. I'm not sure exactly how many.
2009.
That was the first year. Oh, my goodness. So we'll be there. It'll be a great day for you all, as well as your families. It's a wonderful experience for all of them. We'll be talking more about it next episode, and we're also going to kind of use it as a opportunity to celebrate not only our, well, achieving 500 episodes, but also 10 years for the Airplane Geeks podcast. So hopefully we'll see as many of you as possible June 16th. Now we have a bit of a, well, is this a book review? Brian, you received a promotional copy of an interesting book.
Yeah, absolutely not a book review, because I just got it and have just cracked the covers, but found some really, really interesting stuff in it. And who knows, maybe David already has it in his collection. I don't know, but it's called Air Force One, The Aircraft of the Modern U.S. Presidency. And it's a great picture book that goes into a lot of detail of the various planes that have been Air Force One. And some of the things of special note that in just flipping through the book that I came across that I found really, really interesting. There's one section called LBJ's Favorite, the Lockheed C-140 Jetstar. So I'm looking forward to reading as to why that was his favorite. But it's interesting that it's painted in the colors of what we stereotypically think of as Air Force One, with the blue on white color scheme. And then there's another section in the book that talks about, I guess during the Reagan administration, when they were looking at the replacement, Lockheed put forth a TriStar. And having the TriStar, there's an artist rendering of what it would look like in the colors of Air Force One, and some cabin layout stuff. And it's just really, really interesting. I'm looking forward to diving deeper into the book.
Sounds great.
And I'll dovetail, because I have a review copy, and the review is almost done. I thought it was a really good book. What I thought was actually kind of amazing was I showed it to one of my really good friends, and he paid through the book, and he thought it was a comprehensive book on the subject of presidential aircraft, because in it is Navy One, which was George Bush arriving on the deck of the Abraham Lincoln aboard a S-3 Viking, because he was flying it. Well, besides he was flying it, he was aboard it. So therefore, the call sign was not the normal call sign for a Viking, but Navy One. And the book goes into detail. And I don't want to spoil thunder, Brian, but the fact he liked the Jetstar was because it would get him to his ranch in Texas.
Priorities, right?
All of the VIP aircraft have Jackie Kennedy's paint schemes on them, with the exception of the two 707s in the late 70s, which, because of President Carter and austerity, actually went to an all-white paint scheme. He stripped the aircrafts down because he thought that if the economy was so bad, he shouldn't have been flying around in a beautiful blue and white aircraft. And all of that's sort of covered in the book.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to hearing more about that. Also, in other geeks news, Max Trescott, you have another big trip coming up, do you?
Boy, I've had back-to-back-to-back-to-back trips. three back-to-back trips. I canceled one this weekend, and I've got another one coming up in a couple of days. So five back-to-back trips in just under 3 weeks. One was fun. I went up to Yosemite for a couple of days. By the way, it snowed there on the last day we were there, but it's a beautiful national park. But I am headed out in a couple of days to Boston. I'm going to be bringing back a Cirrus SR-22 with two gentlemen who have purchased it and will be probably putting it on lease back here in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's an older one, and so from a weight and balance standpoint, it was pretty challenging. They wanted to have the three of us all fly it back together, but by the time I kind of looked at how much the three of us weighed, how much luggage we were likely to have, we were going to have to reduce the fuel load to the point where it was going to make it a long trip. You know, if we can only fly 2-hour legs instead of 4 or 5-hour legs, boy, that's twice as many fuel stops or more, and it just gives us far fewer options when, you know, things don't work out as we planned, especially in the western part of the country. We've got longer leg distances. We don't have as many airports that we can divert to if we have bad headwinds and start to run, you know, short of gas and stuff like that. So I just heard from them today that they agreed to a plan I suggested, which was that one of them fly with me for the first half of the trip, and that the other one leapfrog ahead and meet us somewhere in the middle of the country, and we'll switch pilots and then continue on to the West Coast. I think they'll both have a much better experience out of it, and we'll have better safety margins since we'll be able to carry a full tank of gas. So looking forward to that. Also, we'll get to hang out with my daughter in Boston for a day prior to bringing that trip, prior to bringing that aircraft back here. So, yes, a lot of traveling going on, lots of fun. The tough challenge, just trying to, you know, figure out how and when and where to get some sleep.
Well, it sounds like a great plan.
Should be fun.
All right. And Max, is there an extra 5-6 minutes for me to go into the 50% thing, or?
What's the 50% thing?
Well, there were two stories that kind of dovetail together, and it's about only knowing half of the story.
Okay. What have you got for us?
About a year and a half ago, this part of the story is going to be actually painful for me because I did something not so smart, but I turned it into a lesson of learning. And it has to do with a flight that I was taking to Singapore. And I was on a flight from, Los Angeles to San Francisco to Singapore. And on the first attempt to get to Singapore, I was actually denied boarding. And I'm not going to go into the details of the situation, but I fired off a letter to the chief pilot and really expressed my views on how this very unjust thing occurred to me. And a few months later, I met with Captain Jeff of Airline Pilot Guy, and Captain Nick was there as well, and Captain Al, who we've also had on the show before. They were all there. And I let them read the letter that I wrote. And none of them knew that the other was reading the letter. But in reading the letter, each of them came up with the same answer or advice to me or conclusion to this letter. It's like, and they said, if they were the captain of the aircraft, they would have denied me boarding as well.
Wow.
And yeah, and hearing their explanation as to why was really important. And that was sort of the lesson learned for me. And they all really said the same thing, which was, had the captain heard my version of the story and allowed me on the plane and something were to have gone wrong, the captain would become liable at that point because he didn't listen to his fellow crew members or fellow coworkers. And that sort of, I mean, that really does make sense to me. It's you just, from a liability standpoint, you just can't take the risk. So that's knowing the other half. It really changed my attitude. And I really felt bad at that point over writing the letter to the chief pilot, because if I had their perspective of the situation, it would have changed my view.
So did you write back to the chief pilot with your newfound knowledge?
No, I never actually thought to do that. That's actually a really good point, and I probably should, even though it's a year and a half, 2 years later at this point. So I don't know if I'm just opening up a can of worms at that point.
Well, probably not. I mean, they might have forgotten about it completely, but I would imagine just relating that, you know, that story, that the fact that you learned the other side of the story, the other 50%, they might enjoy that.
And who knows? It might actually enable me to continue to fly United at some point in the future as well.
He might let you back on, huh?
Yeah, yeah. The other 50% involves a story or a conversation that I kind of had with David. And David, if you could let me tell this and then join in, I'd really like to get your opinion on it and or correct some things that I might get wrong here. But about a month ago, there were some aircraft flying over, and I sent actually all you guys the picture of what I thought was an F-16, or there were a whole bunch of F-16s flying overhead. And I took a picture, sent it to you guys. David corrected me and said that it was actually a T-38, not an F-16. Fair enough. But there was an awful lot of conversation in the neighborhood as well. And there's a website called Nextdoor. And the Nextdoor website, if you're not familiar with it, allows a community of people in your neighborhood to get together and discuss various things that's going on in your neighborhood. Well, the sighting of these aircraft was definitely the topic of of the week, and everyone was speculating on what they were and why they were doing in the air over our heads and flying so low and all that. And it finally came out that they were there for opening day of the Dodgers were playing, so they were going to do the flyover at opening day, and they were practicing the day before. And so many people were outraged on Nextdoor that what a waste it was for these aircraft to fly from some base in middle of America. I believe it was Missouri, but I'm not sure. But it's just like, why not use if you're going to use military aircraft, why not use military aircraft that are closer? And is it such a good use of our tax dollar funds to pay for all of that fuel and all the time? And why so many jets and all? You know, it just seems like a tremendous waste. And everyone in the Nextdoor community was pretty much in agreement that it was a real waste. And then, of course, I couldn't hold back any longer. And David, this is where you could correct me if I'm right or wrong on this. But the story that I told is, hey, these are training aircraft. It's really important for pilots to do long distance flying. So if they have to go somewhere, why not come here? Doing a precision approach, or not precision approach, but a precision timing for, let's say, right after the national anthem plays and do the flyover, that's really good training for their military career and things that pilots have to plan. So why not do it over Dodger Stadium for opening day, as opposed to, let's say, flying over somewhere in, I don't know, pick a state, you know, Texas, Arizona, whatever, and pick a dark spot on the ground and try and do a timed, synchronized timing to that event. Why not use the ball game? And in this particular case, you could actually inspire some kids that are at the ballpark and get them interested in the military. And I said, yeah, what a great use of our tax resource. And so many people changed their opinion and actually said, yeah, that is a really good idea. And that was a good use of funds. So knowing the other half of the story becomes, I think, really, really important. So before we jump to conclusions, I think we should actually listen to the other side or investigate the other side and really form an opinion at that point.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation and a life lesson maybe that seems a lot of people lack these days. It seems to be very popular to latch onto a position and, you know, feel very strongly about that without thinking about the other side or a different perspective, another way to look at it, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good lesson. It's a very good lesson.
Yes, I don't know. David, I mean, is it correct that these pilots, the T-38 pilots, would need to do long cross-country flights and doing their timing of the flyover is actually, there is a practical military application for this training exercise?
I'll keep my mouth shut and defer to the two pilots. Is cross-country an important part of aviation training to our two instructor pilots?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's very important.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it depends on how much they're doing and how they're doing it and, you know, where they're coming from and who's in charge. I mean, I'm sorry, who's flying the airplane? Is it someone that's an old experienced hand? I mean, they might not get quite as much out of a long distance flight as someone that's newer, but of course it's part of growing up.
Okay, I just want to make sure that I was right in what I said on the Nextdoor comment, that this was actually a really valuable military exercise that they could go through, and it was a good use of our taxpayer funds because they would have spent it someplace else doing the very same training.
Yeah, I find that flying long cross countries is very different from flying the little short 50 nautical mile cross countries that pilots are required to do as part of getting their license. And so pilots learn a heck of a lot when they go on these long trips because there are just a lot of things that just don't come up on the short trips they're used to doing.
All right. You may recall that a number of episodes ago, we were talking about lithium ion batteries and thermal runaway and the fact that many airlines now have containment bags or products of some sort to receive lithium ion batteries that are in distress. And we talked about how does that work and what do you do with the bag and just the whole process. So we didn't know. So what we did is we asked in our Slack listener team if somebody would volunteer to do a little bit of research and learn more about these lithium ion containment products and give us a report. And we were very fortunate to have Nick volunteer to do some research, which he did. And he passed that along to us and just want to relate some of that to you. So Nick says that he searched around. He found 9 products that claim to be solutions to lithium ion battery thermal runaway on aircraft. And he noted that all of these products work along the same basic lines. There's some kind of fire-resistant containment vessel. It might be a bag or it might be a box. There's some method for moving the personal electronic device into that vessel. Personal electronic device could be a laptop or a tablet or something like that, a PED, personal electronic device. And third, that there's some method for sealing this containment vessel. Now, he said the majority of products he found are bags of different levels of sophistication and rigidity. Some of these bags offer 100% containment of fire, heat, fumes, and smoke. Some involve the addition of water from outside. Some are designed to obviate the need for additional water. Either they inject their own solution or avoid the use of water altogether. And one uses non-toxic mineral crystals to suppress and extinguish the fire, as well as to absorb the heat and fumes and smoke and all of that. He also found that there are 2 of them that are rigid containers that also eliminate the need for the person from handling the PED directly with gloves. And some of these products use built-in systems to inject fire suppressant or coolant. Now, Nick found that prices for these things range from around $500 to around $5,000. Interestingly, most manufacturers of these things offer lifetime replacement guarantees. So if their product is used to handle a PED or battery thermal runaway, then they'll give you a replacement for that. He also found that some of the manufacturers, well, kind of play up alleged FAA certification, but he says he hasn't verified these certifications. And indeed, the FAA in 2017 issued a warning about unsubstantiated claims for these kinds of products. At that time, the FAA had no standards or certifications that could have been applied or to these products or against which they could have been tested. And the FAA also raised the point of extra risks generated by allegedly approved products that don't include a safe way to handle the PEDs or batteries in thermal runaway. Now, there's some contentious points. Several manufacturers and pundits, he found, make a big deal about the alleged incompatibility of water and lithium batteries. And we had that conversation because we'd run across that. In some cases, the directions are to add water. He says that although this may be true for lithium metal batteries, at least for airliners, the main risk comes from lithium ion batteries, as opposed to these lithium metal batteries, which do not contain lithium in its metal form. Hence, he says, there is arguably no risk from using water to deal with thermal runaway. Further, the primary requirement when dealing with a lithium-ion battery thermal runaway is removing the heat. Hence, most operating procedures for handling a PED thermal runaway involve the use of a fire extinguisher to eliminate any fire, followed by water or something similar to remove the heat and stop the runaway. Now, he says there's a caveat. There's been minimal discussion, really, about the risk of a lithium-ion thermal runaway that causes magnesium components to catch fire. And, of course, in that case, you don't want to add water when you've got magnesium in the mix because of the reaction that you will that will result. As for product details, he says that well, let's just look at some of these products just to give you an idea. There's Air Care International. Some of these names, and this is the Fire Sock, is the product name. Some of these names will be kind of amusing, but this is the marketing material isn't completely clear. It appears to be a pouch that would fit a laptop. There's fire resistant gloves that come come with them. It's also designed for safer transportation of a PED rather than for the specific needs of dealing with a lithium ion thermal runaway. Another company, AvSax, has a product that's specifically designed to reduce the heat levels. There's a polymer gel inside the bag. It's activated by water, causes the bag to expand around the device. AvSax says that they are on board 35 major carriers, so that would appear to be a kind of a market leader in this space. They say that apparently about 20 have been deployed so far, quote, this year. Not sure what this year is. So that's AvSax. There's Baker Aviation, the Hot Stop L product. They claim it's the safest way to contain a lithium ion fire. Comes in different sizes, ranging from sort of a phone size to a larger laptop size. There's also from Brimstone Fire Protection, the battery explosion and fire containment bag. They say that has a shelf life of 12 years. It's got Velcro sealing flaps. It's designed to contain the heat and the gases and any shrapnel that might result. Comes in a couple of sizes. There's also from Cell Block Fire Containment Systems, the lithium ion battery incident kit. And this uses a something they call Cell Block EX. They call it an environmentally friendly mineral-based fire extinguishing agent composed of non-crystalline glass granules. These little spheres consist of foamed recycled glass with tiny pores on the inside. They form a closed cell structure. And the claim is these little things absorb the heat and the oxygen and the gases of thermal runaway. In this product, no water or halon or anything else is required. There's also Fire Containment Concepts. Their product is the Emergency Fire Containment System. They claim to contain and extinguish PED and lithium battery fires, as well as 98% of the resultant smoke. Uses an attached self-contained automatic suppression system. When a predetermined temperature is exceeded, an aqueous agent is released to cool and suppress the fire. Therefore, if you have an issue with a PED and you put it in there, if it doesn't actually go into thermal runaway, that aqueous agent isn't used. Comes in a variety of sizes. There's also the company Flight Fire Containment Systems. Their product is the Aircraft PED Fires Containment and Extinguisher System. They call it the world's first and only aircraft PED lithium ion battery fire containment and extinguisher system. They have a patent on this. This particular design is interesting because it doesn't require the operator to directly handle the PED with gloves. It's got a pull-up flame-resistant shroud that will even deal with an entire backpack, or at least a small one. Interesting, it's got a built-in halon fire extinguisher. And then from High Water Innovations, there's the Plane Guard. It's approved and supplied to Gulfstream, they say. Contains the fire and the gases. It includes a scoop for handling the PED. Does require adding water from outside the box. And it's sort of a case-like device. And then the last one is from Nutex Industries, the Z-Block Fire Containment Bag. It's sold as a kit with gloves and a silica fire blanket. They do claim a range of certifications. I'm not sure what those are exactly. There's a couple of different sizes. There's a minimum order quantity. So if you're thinking about buying just one of these for your general aviation or business aircraft, that's probably not the option. So we want to thank Nick for doing a lot of work. We have links to all of these companies, the products. If you have some personal interest in these kinds of products, write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we can share with you the websites and some more details of Nick's research. But again, we really, really want to thank him for looking into this. We really didn't know what these fire containment bags looked like, how they worked, how much they cost, what the different types were. But Nick has provided us with a lot of great information, and really, really want to thank him for that.
Cool stuff. And I'm surprised there are so many solutions. I was just thinking there might have been one or two.
Yeah.
And wow, thanks for doing all that research. That had to have taken a tremendous amount of time.
Last week, we talked about Sun and Fun, and since last episode, the Sun and Fun has come and finished, and our Airplane Geeks reporter-at-large, Launchpad Merzari, was there, and he's recorded a couple of pieces for us. We have two short ones for you this episode, probably more to come in the future, but we can start off with a quick pilot report from Launchpad Merzari on this year's Sun and Fun.
Hello, Airplane Geeks listeners. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, with a pie wrap for Sun and Fun 2018. Well, Sun and Fun 2018 can best be described as being bookend by awful weather. Tuesday, first day of the show, it started raining about 10 o'clock in the morning and didn't stop until about 9 o'clock that night. Not a lot of fun to walk around outside in the rain and look at airplanes. So everybody concentrated inside the different vendors' tents and booths, at which there was a lot of good stuff to look at there. The rest of the week was gorgeous. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday was just perfect weather in the high 70s, mid 80s, light breeze to keep you cool. As many of you have heard already, due to a tragedy, the Thunderbirds have temporarily suspended their schedule. The DoD stepped up. The Navy sent an F-18 Super Hornet TAC demo, so we had an F-18 flying around. The Air Force sent their F-16 demo team, which put on a really good loud show. And we also had a C-17 come in for static display. So the military was not underrepresented. But there was always great flying, including the Aeroshell team, which really outdid themselves this year in performances, and the two night air shows were spectacular. Everybody was looking at the weather. Sunday, we could tell the weather was going to roll in. In fact, the Sun and Fun organization announced that the show would close at 1, not at 5, and that there would be no Sunday air show. Immediately, the vendors started moving their airplanes and flying out. The only different part was that all the pyro for the Tora 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 show had already been laid, so the fire chief announced that they were going to blow it in place right then and there. So at 11 o'clock, we all walked out to watch all the pyro go off, including the wall of fire, in 1 3-minute space of time. That was kind of different. It was a good show with many classes and seminars provided by many of the organizations. So keep listening to Sun and Fun Radio for more details. But this is your reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Yeah, I guess if you've got all the pyro in place, you might as well set it off. Wouldn't you think, Rob?
And that's why I agree with that.
Yeah, I think it's probably more dangerous moving it than to set it off. I think those things were designed to be put in place and fired instead of moved around multiple times, right?
Yeah, really. How much do you think they'd have to pay you to be the guy to go out there when they say, why don't you go back out and disconnect all that stuff?
Yeah, sure.
That's why we need Max Treskin.
Exactly. Hey, have you guys ever felt the heat in your face from one of those when they go off? I mean, it's amazing when the wind blows.
I felt that at Oshkosh.
Oh, it's incredible how much heat is generated by those things.
Also from Launchpad, a short interview. He was, this is kind of fun. Launchpad was kind of confused a little bit because this seemed to be kind of a case of getting something for nothing, maybe getting a lot for just about nothing other than your service. So let's listen to Launchpad here.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and here at Sun and Fun Air Show, and I'm with
Chief Warrant Officer 3, Chuck Villanita from the United States Army Aviation Proponent.
And I'm with him, and I'm getting really confused. Let me get this straight. You're looking to hire non-pilots.
That is correct.
So I'm going to show up without any experience, and you're willing to teach me to become a pilot.
I will teach you and pay you to do it.
So all I got to do is be a high school graduate with good moral character.
That is correct.
And you're going to teach me to become to lead and be a warrant officer.
That is correct.
And then you're going to teach me how to fly.
That is correct.
So I'm going to get to fly like things like the new Dakota?
That is correct.
And then from there I could end up in something really cool like an Apache or a Blackhawk?
Or the mighty CH-47 Chinook.
Okay. And this whole time I'm going to get a paycheck.
That is correct.
Full health benefits.
That is correct.
Housing.
That is correct.
And I also get to put money away for a college program.
Absolutely.
That's matching funds for a college program.
That's correct.
Okay, just getting this all in. And, all right, where do I sign up?
Well, Launchpad, when did you graduate high school?
Well, not in this century.
Well, you might have to be at least 33 and below to be able to sign up.
Okay, I missed that train. But you're just looking to take kids from high school to flight to a certified pilot in 14 months?
That is correct.
And you're going to pay them?
Absolutely.
Like real money?
Correct.
Okay, where do they go to do this?
They can go to GoArmy.com, or they can go to the Warrant Officer Recruiting website.
There you have it, folks. Somebody who's willing to teach you to fly and pay you to learn to fly on their dime, and you'll be serving your country, too. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
I think that just goes to show you that they're really short of people interested in flying. And we knew it was going to start coming to this where people were going to start getting paid to learn to fly, even though they may not have had a college degree. And I think this is the first, what do we call it, the camel's nose under the tent?
Rob, the Army has wanted you to fly out of high school for years. When I graduated high school, one of the options was to go into the Army because they'll take you for flight school to fly helos without a college degree. The Army's always had that attitude. They still have warrant officers. It's the Air Force now that's looking back and going, well, maybe we need to rethink this whole, I have to be an officer to fly airplanes. But the Army has always, you could not have a college degree and you could learn to fly helicopters. In fact, one of my good friends, Austin Bowman, who is now actually an officer, was enlisted, flew as crew chief, and I met him when he was in the Golden Knights, and then eventually got selected to go to officer candidate school to become an officer. But you can fly helicopters without a license or a college degree if you want to serve in the United States Army.
But that's a really cool program, though. What a great opportunity for some kids coming out of high school. I wish I would have known about that because I certainly didn't know at the time.
Yeah. And now it's too late for you, Brian.
Yeah, like Launchpad, I kind of missed that date.
Yeah, yeah. All right, just a little bit of listener mail. We've heard from a bunch of folks over the course of the last week or so. Adam wrote to us. Adam is a real seasoned traveler, and he describes all the international flying he's done for a number of years. But he did tell us about a recent experience with United. And since we've been talking about United experiences a lot lately. I think we should include his. He writes, I was booked Charlotte Douglas International Airport to Washington Dulles to Heathrow to Frankfurt with the first two segments on United. He says, I was attracted to the Dulles and Heathrow section to fly on a United Dreamliner. Well, my Dreamliner experience vanished with an email saying that the flight was delayed by about 90 minutes and that since he had about 90 minutes to connect, he instantly went to the United desk by the gate. He said there that one of the employees was most helpful. She kept my Charlotte to Dulles section and then booked me on a Dulles to Frankfurt flight the next day, promising me a hotel and food vouchers for D.C. Arriving at Dulles, I was quickly served at the United customer service desk and was booked in the Dulles Hilton and given two $10 meal vouchers. My only real complaint is, and this is minor, is I feel a $10 meal voucher doesn't quite cover even a reasonable meal. But he says one benefit of this delay was the hotel's shuttle service to the Udvarhazy Museum and a morning spent at this impressive museum. I remember, he says, one of your podcasts about the Udvarhazy. After the museum visit, I headed to the airport for my rescheduled flight. The boarding process was horrendous, he says. I've blocked this out of my mind. However, beyond that, the flight and the attendants were superb. Plenty of food, attentive service, more than enough drink, including ample amounts of wine or water, and up-to-date movies that made my 7.5-hour flight fly by. Really, when I think about only the flight and the ground support, I have no complaints. So will I fly United again on this route? Possibly. I might just allow more time in D.C. to transfer between flights. This being said, I've taken the Charlotte to Dulles flight quite often and never had a delay that forced me to alter my route. So in closing, Adam writes, I feel that United do many things right. However, I sometimes wonder that when airlines or other corporations are too big, that they have a greater difficulty being consistent. In the end, this lack of consistency will always hamper them. And that's from Adam, which I think is an interesting point. Yeah, when you're big, you're going to have a lot, you know, the number of transactions goes up, and providing consistent service across all of them, that can be pretty difficult. So. Well, we thank Adam for writing in to us.
Yeah, and I still find it interesting. I mean, Rob and I certainly have our opinion on United, and I think I've always tried to say that there are some really good people at United that really try and do the right thing and
yeah.
do good by passengers, and that's great. I'm not sure if Adam has a high frequent flyer status with United. And I find it interesting that he got a hotel room because in situations like that, I believe it's only United 1Ks that are entitled to a free hotel room. So if he doesn't have 1K status, I think, again, they went above and beyond in providing him a room when they weren't obligated to do so. So, you know, well done, United, for doing the right thing.
Very good.
And by the same token, if we might mention, long as we're talking about our favorite airline, I had a friend that was going to Sun and Fun last week, and she got caught in some horrendous L.A. traffic, and she got to LAX and the United gate just, I guess, at the 10-minute point. And they said, nope, sorry, doors closed. And it was a direct flight from LAX to Orlando. And, you know, she said it was very frustrating to miss the flight knowing that all they had to do was just open the door and let me on. But they had their rules.
Yeah.
And then the plane was a few minutes late getting out of the gate anyway. And it just sat there with the door closed and this person on the other side standing there saying, you couldn't just open the door and just let me on. I mean, I've already got a ticket. And they go, nope, sorry, rules. And that is, you know, I tried to explain that to her this morning, that is what I see as one of the biggest problems at United is they have procedures and they just Certainly except, of course, what we just heard here, I mean, that Brian was talking about. But I'm just saying that they often seem to say that's the rule and we can't change anything. And that's very frustrating for any passenger.
Although, Rob, with the other bit that I just talked about, knowing the other 50%, maybe because she was late, United does have the 20 minutes before flight, the cutoff policy that if you're not there, they could give up your seat. Maybe they gave up her seat, so there was no seat for her to sit in. Therefore, opening the door would have been completely useless.
Well, they now, had the flight the airplane attendant wasn't. They said the airplane wasn't full, and that was the part that I thought it was 10 minutes.
I believe it's 20, but I could be getting that confused with international flights. No,
it's crazy to cut passengers off 20 minutes before the flight leaves. I'm sorry. That's crazy. I wouldn't like it if any airline did it.
Right. But now they're saying to show up 2 hours ahead of time for a domestic flight, which I also think is crazy as well.
And I think that's so they can try and keep their on-time arrival record good. Yes. You know, if you're there early, then they can dash out early.
Yeah, I don't know. I can drive pretty far in 2 hours, I tell you.
That's a really good point.
All right, we have time for one more listener mail. And this really could have made the news section. This was from Neil, Air New Zealand passengers face more disruptions as Dreamliners hit by further Rolls-Royce engine problems. We talked about some of those problems in an earlier episode. And the, Rolls-Royce and the EASA, the European regulator, have issued a directive. It requires operators of the, certain types of Trent 1000 engines. They're called Package C. They have to carry out earlier than usual maintenance checks on the engine compressor, but also just like this is almost breaking news, I think the FAA has decreased the ETOPS rating for Boeing 787 Dreamliners using those Trent 1000 Package C engines, reducing the ETOPS rating that has been 330 minutes of flight time down to 140 minutes, which can have a huge impact on, you know, the route you have to fly. There's a big difference, 140 minutes of flight time versus 330 minutes. Of course, with ETOPS, rating, that's the maximum flight time that you have to maintain between a suitable landing spot. So, for example, instead of going straight across the Atlantic, you may have to fly a completely different route that would take you over or closer to land areas where there's an opportunity to land. So this is a significant issue for Rolls-Royce right now with the those Trent 1000 engines. So, but thanks to Neil for sending that along to us.
Yeah, that's definitely a big deal. And in 2 weeks, I'm going to be going back over to Germany and flying on a 777. And I guess I'm just really fortunate that the carrier that I'm going on does not have any of these Trent 1000s, as far as I know, and won't be affected. But yeah, that could definitely affect their routing and even the ability to do certain flights.
Yeah.
You know, for example, Air New Zealand can't do the Los Angeles Auckland flight, I believe, as a result of the reduction in ETOPS.
The other engine option on the 787, of course, is the GE Aviation engine. That's the GE NX-1B. So it's the fleet is a mixture of those GE engines and the Rolls-Royce engines, which are experiencing these problems.
And Max, the Package C, is that kind of like in computers when you have various revisions of software or even the computer hardware? They'll make, let's say, version 1 for a bit, then move it to version 2, then version 3. Are these packages that way, or is there something else that determines what an engine package is?
It's pretty similar. A lot of times it can be a fuel burn improvement package. So, for example, if you buy this package, which will mean that typically, unless it's just a software change, typically at a maintenance shop visit, you install some different parts. You buy these parts and you install these parts, And so that brings you up to this revision, this package level. And then you get to enjoy some, you know, specific increase in fuel economy. Or it could be a reliability package, something that says, well, if you swap out the old parts for these new parts, then the new parts are going to last so much longer than the old version of those parts, and that will extend the maintenance cycle. It can be a variety of different things, but yeah, it's kind of along those general lines.
Okay, cool.
But sometimes it can be just software. These things are all FADIC controlled, of course, so sometimes it's just a software change that you basically pay for it because there's some benefit, even though it's just a software change, which doesn't have any real incremental cost to the engine company. All right. Well, with all that, let's bring this one to a close. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Certainly visit us at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find show notes there for all of our episodes. If you'd like to go straight to the show notes for this episode, then visit airplanegeeks.com/499. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Brian Coleman, where do we reach you?
People can get a hold of me at brian@airplanegeeks.com. And if anyone's interested in listening to previous episodes of the Airplane Geeks podcast, they can go to airplanegeeks.com/archive.
And Max Trescott.
Oh, all the usual places. When you search on Max Trescott with a T, you're going to have to sort out the hundreds of other people with that name. Fortunately, my parents were worried that I have a good Google name when I was born, so you're not going to find any other one, I don't think. But yeah, Max Truscott on Twitter, Facebook, and of course, always at aviationnewstalk.com. And if you want to fly with me out here in California, just go ahead and click on contact when you're at aviationnewstalk.com.
Cool. Rob Mark, where do we find you?
Any place that has Jetwine in the name or Flying Magazine in the name. And I'm just glad, actually, that people no longer can find me on the wall in the post office. And if you don't get that, it's because you're not old enough.
Where does your wife look to find you?
I think that's probably the TMI debate. Yeah.
I only ask because I had no idea what you might say.
Yeah.
Didn't you find him in a mail order husband catalog?
Yeah. No comment.
Part of the spring discount package or something?
Fake news. I'm sorry. Fake news.
And David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
You can find me on Twitter. You can find me usually at the Ud Varhazy Center at the National Air and Space Museum. You can, of course, find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, if our show would publish on time for some reason. The UAVDigest.com.
So, yeah, the UAV Digest, we publish it, and it's been taking like hours and hours and hours and sometimes a day to appear. I have an idea what might be the problem, so we'll see what happens on Friday. Otherwise, you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, also at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. And please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
Night.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.